Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Stop me if I've told you this before, but both Mark and I used to edit a magazine called Smash Hits. And, yeah, there you go. And the legacy of having edited Smash Hits is that all over the world where you go, you meet people who used to read Smash Hits. And you also meet a significant number of them who said, what made me want to be a writer was reading in Smash Hits, which is probably what they say to the editor of Flexi Pop and, you know, and the Melody Maker and everywhere. But anyway, you know, we cherish these bits of feedback that we get from people who once read Smash Hits. And our next guest, I feel confident in saying, has written the best book ever to be written by a former reader of Smash Hits.
Wow.
And is, I also confidently predict, is about to do for kind of uncelebrated pop music what Nick Hornby did for football with Fever Pitch. Because fulsome has been the welcome to his fantastic memoir, Broken Greek. Please welcome Pete Pavides.
Thank you, David. That was, what a lovely introduction. Thank you.
And we should mention the reaction, because it's been absolutely fantastic, hasn't it? I mean, the last three or four, the book came out, what, 3 or 4 days ago, and it's just been just uproarious applause.
I mean,
I talked to you this morning, you said you've been levitating on the euphoria.
Yeah, it's never going to happen again, is it? So I'm just completely, like, drinking it all up, and I feel like, to say I feel like a competition winner is the biggest understatement of all time. You know, I just never thought I would find myself in this position.
And tell people about the people who played at your launch party the other day.
Well, that's part of it. I mean,
yeah, it's just brilliant.
Okay, so I had a launch party for the book at the social on Little Portland Street on Friday night, and I arranged it. You know, when you, my publishers had certain ideas. They say you could have it in a bookshop, you could have it here, you could have it there. I said, well, let's try and make it a little bit sort of vibey, and I'll try and invite my mates, and we can even get some live music. So I kind of did I was struggling to find a venue that was free initially, and I did a shout out on Facebook, and one person who I'm friends with on Facebook is Mike Batt, probably most famous for being the guy behind the Wombles musical incarnation. And Mike is a lovely man. He's a very modest man and very self-deprecating, always eager to help. And he said, no bother if you don't want me to, but, you know, I can get up and do a couple of songs if you want me to. I was like, are you kidding? You know, he's mentioned in the book the Wombles kind of quite an important sort of phenomenon earlier on in the book. I said, yes, I would like you to play some songs, you know, and secretly hoping he'll remember you're a Womble. And anyway, one thing led to another. Mike's friends with the composer David Arnold, who is married to Eos Council, who's the lead violinist in a classical pop crossover group called Bond. So suddenly, like, one thing led to another. They were suddenly in this kind of ad hoc combo. The Rails got involved, who are, for people who don't know, James Walborn, who's a guitarist in The Pretenders, and Cammy Thompson. Dan Gillespie-Sells from The Feelings somehow entered the equation. Then Mike was going to do Bright Eyes, so Kate St. John offered to do oboe on Bright Eyes. And then Helen O'Hara ended up, from Dex's
Fantastic.
Midnight Runners, ended up joining this putative supergroup. And
Chrissy Hynde played Chain Gang.
And so at the launch, unbeknownst to me, James Walborn invited Chrissy Hynde along. And I'm doing, like, my speeches to thank my publishers and my family and what have you. And I could just see Chrissy Hynde at the front there.
Yeah.
What's Chrissy Hynde doing at my... I don't think I invited Chrissy. I mean, you know, I mean, I can't believe she's here. Yeah, I love Chrissy Hynde, but... And, you know, I went into a kind of shock, and I knew that Back on the Chain Gang was in the set, but I just didn't somehow compute that maybe what was coming. And then, anyway, track two, and James Walborn gesticulated to Chrissy. Suddenly she was on stage, and I was watching the supergroup of my dreams play at my book launch, for a launch for a book that I didn't even think I'd ever finish, playing Back on the Chain Gang. I mean, God... And that's before we even get on to the final Remember You're a Womble with Helen O'Hara playing violin. And, you know, and David Arnold playing guitar.
So the book launch of the year will be remembered, you know, as climaxing with Remember You're a Womble, which is what anybody in publishing would have predicted.
You know what? If you could have bottled what was in the room at that point and, you know, manufactured it to order, you would have solved every problem in the world. Yeah. It was just wonderful.
So anyway, this couldn't be, you know, more out of character with the way you started this book, because you did it in a rather unusual way, didn't you?
Yeah, I just sort of... I just started writing, and I had a couple of ideas that were sort of half-shaped. I sort of thought that... There's a way of writing about music that you can sort of interweave with personal. The way we sort of love music, we don't love it in a vacuum. We love it because of all the things that are going on in our lives. And early on, I feel, certainly in my experience, that all the bands I loved, all the album, the records I liked, were records that seemed to be in one way or another explaining my situation to me, and pointing future possible versions of me that I could sort of set my sort of sat nav for, if you see what I mean, and that's kind of clear to me now. It wasn't necessarily clear to me then, but it is clear to me now. And I think that might have been accentuated by the fact that my parents are Greek Cypriot. They ran a fish and chip shop. They had a very different upbringing to mine. So there's a sort of vacuum where you're trying to figure out your identity. So I just started writing. I just thought, I'll just start writing and see what happens and see if it turns into a book. And then I thought, this idea is unpitchable because it's quite confused. It's kind of two books interwoven into one. But you can't really separate them, because I can't tell this story without telling the story of how my parents got here and how that impacted upon. So I'm just going to have to write this, really. And so I did it, and then I handed it to a publisher at the end.
So this is always an impossible question to ask, to answer, but how long did it take you to write it? Because it's a long book, isn't it?
Yeah, I started in earnest at the beginning of 2017, and I finished... A draft that I was happy to show people, I finished almost exactly 2 years later, around February 2019.
And you were working at it pretty much all the time, were you?
Yeah, pretty much. I host a show for Soho Radio, so that takes me about a day to prepare. So I try and do that for my own sanity as much as anything else. And I wasn't really doing much music journalism throughout that time, you know, so I would do it sort of, you know, while I was waiting to pick up one of my kids from school, or sort of, you know, I'd sort of do it, you know, when there were no demands being made upon me in my other areas of my life.
Right. So then you finished it, took it to a publisher, and sold it.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't be that simple. I wasn't expecting it to be that simple.
Well, you're in a very strong position if you finished the whole book. I mean, you know, people know what they're buying.
Well...
It's an unpitchable idea, actually. Yeah. I mean, now that it's been written, it's, you know, it's a bit like there's a record I write about in the book called, you know, the Adam and the Ants Kings of the Wild Frontier album, and that's really an unpitchable idea as well. You know, a band largely comprised of sort of punk failures who had almost tried everything under the sun to just try and get some kind of purchase. Punks found them ridiculous. These people had no chance of being pop stars. The lead singer has just lost his entire band, so he has to recruit a whole other band. And then he has this idea that if he writes a load of songs about cowboys and Indians and pirates and puts a white stripe across his, that might somehow get him a record deal.
Yeah.
Or the Human League, where they sack the sort of talented
yes,
musicians,
absolutely.
And then replace them with schoolgirls. That's an idea so insane that only success can vindicate it. Nothing else. And so similarly, that
right.
my book isn't quite as crazy as those things, but that's I had to write it so that people could see it, and actually maybe it wasn't as messy an idea as it would have been if I explained it.
So it's a pop music story, but it's also a family story and a personal story.
Yeah, it starts. It starts when we spend this idyllic summer in Cyprus, and that really is a recce that my parents have gone on because they're planning to move. They've been in this country for 10 years. They're deeply homesick, and they're sort of starting to plan their return, their escape. They run a fish and chip shop in Birmingham, and then the Turkish invasion of Cyprus happens, the island is partitioned, my dad can't go back to the village where he grew up, so all plans are off. It's sort of too dangerous. And so I return to start infant school, and the sort of discombobulation of starting at infant school renders me... So I stop talking to people, and it's called selective muteness. But I stopped talking to everyone apart from my family, and I would only talk to members of my family if there were no other people in the room, or to my teachers if no children were listening, and not always even then. And that carried on for 3 years.
Which gave you a very, very strong connection with pop music, didn't it? I mean, there was a bit where you talk about Leo Sayer's single at the time. As you think that that's a song that's written by you about your own mother?
In a way, I mean, it's the book sort of opens with this journey coming back from this sort of psychiatrist who is trying to get me to talk, and it's a failure, and we're coming back in the car, and when I need you, he's playing on the radio. And this is the thing; it's kind of hard to sort of convey to younger people, you know. When you're young and you listen to music, it's very intense. You know, you hear a disembodied voice on the radio. You don't know who Leo Sayer is. You don't know what the song is. You don't know what the title is. It is a wholly metaphysical presence. And the great thing about being a young child, and I think we all have equivalents of this, is that you become the song. The song somehow personifies you. You personify the song. And the sentiments of "When I Need You" at that time, I had it with My Sweet Lord as well. Those were the two songs I remember just being somehow... I kind of felt like they were kind of me. I don't know. That's the best way I can put it. And certainly in the case of When I Need You, I was singing about my mum because it was that sort of total all-consuming love that at that age is a sort of... Yeah, with a bit of luck, you do feel for your mother.
And you got worried that your parents were going to abandon you, and you thought that if you were adopted by anybody, you'd want it to be the Brotherhood of Man. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm.
There they are.
They just looked lovely, didn't they? What the not talking thing did, it made me feel very guilty. It made me feel like I was kind of screwing up, and that guy over here,
we're looking at little Jimmy Osmond.
He was my nemesis because every time he came on the television, I would scurry behind the sofa and start crying, and he was everything that I had failed at being. He was this very obliging, sunny, you know, together child. That's how he seemed to me, and I was this kind of mute freak who was just not playing the game. I was not, and so I started kind of obsessing upon people like this because I just thought it was entirely understandable. I loved my parents, but it was entirely understandable that if the opportunity arose, they'd return me to the shop or something. And and these guys just seemed great, and also I was starting to see myself as English. So if I was going to choose,
yes, I was going to say because your given name is
Takis. So my parents, my full name is Panayotis, and that long story short, my parents call me Takis because it's a kind of comminution. Is that the word? Anyway, it's And so I started at at primary school and announced to my teacher at the end of infant school that when I started at primary school, I was to be called Peter. And I wasn't really expecting this to happen, but when the new term started, and God knows why they took this request seriously, I was suddenly Peter on the register.
And your parents didn't know this?
I think they knew, but I think that maybe they thought it would pass or something. Or that I think, you know, all parents were really, really busy in the 70s, you know, because, you know, dishwashers hadn't been invented. And,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There's a lot to do, you know. Life was very inconvenient. And so I'd start to, and I remember watching the Eurovision Song Contest with my mum the year that Brotherhood of Man won with Sable Kisses for Me. And I just loved them, you know. I just loved, and that song, which is like, and that song really represents the sort of cycles one can go through as a music fan through life. Because I loved it in a very pure and sincere way. It was a song about a small child, and then, you know, you become a teenager, and you kind of you impugn dark motives into things that don't necessarily have dark motives. So you say, "Ugh, they're paedophiles." They say, even though you're only three, "Ugh." And then you become a dad, and then you learn all over again that there's this incredibly pure, intense, all-consuming love that you feel for your children, and not only would you sing a song like that for them, you'd record, you know, entire operas for them, you know, and so you go full circle.
So, but one of the things that interests me in the book is that pop music is a way of making you British, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And that is completely apparent to me now in a way that I couldn't necessarily have articulated it to myself at the time.
And did you feel a kind of tension about it? Did you feel a sort of sense of guilt? Because your parents were obviously bringing you up in a strongly Greek culture, listening to Greek music and eating Greek food, and, you know, and there were you going off and being seduced by British culture. I mean, did that cause tension?
Yeah, so the archetypes of pop star, the archetypal pop stars that I liked were very sort of together, square, straight sort of British people. You know, Olivia Newton-John was, I know she was Australian, but I wasn't necessarily making that distinction at that point. Kiki D, you know, the heavenly platonic ideal of the childminder that you would want to have, you know, very kind of.
As you talk about Elkie Brooks being the nightmare childminder, you're terrified of the idea that Elkie Brooks might turn up one day.
Well, I would watch. I would watch Top of the Pops, and these would be the criteria, you know. So, you know, so obviously Brotherhood of Man, great, you know. Olivia Newton-John, apart from the final scene in Greece where. You know, why did she have to go and do that? Why couldn't she be?
Yeah.
Cigarette, you know.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I remember, so there was a Top of the Pops when Elkie Brooks came on and did Pearls as a Singer. And it just sounded satanic to me. It just sounded it just sounded like slow, ghostly, deathly music, like old people kind of rotting, and I just thought that was my seventh or eighth birthday party. You can date it, because obviously we're doing the Bruce Forsyth thinker pose. That's what we're doing there.
Right.
And that's what that is.
Did you have loads of mates?
Not very much. That paints a slightly. It was my birthday party, and that was the birthday party that we had the final year that we had a fish and chip shop. So, obviously, lots of people wanted to go to it, because a birthday party in a fish and chip shop. Why would you not want to go to that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And my parents closed. It was in the afternoon when the shop was closed. My parents, who would normally close the shop and turn the fryers off, kept the fryers on. And they seated us at a table, and we all had sort of chips. And then there was, in my parents' shop in Birmingham, there was a back room which was full of pinball machines and a pool table. And my dad, obviously, the way you put free goes on a pinball machine was by unlocking the front panel, and there's like a little wire that you press down, which is like the weight of the coin usually makes it go down, and that gives you a game. And so my dad opened the front panels of all the machines, and he kind of put loads of games. I mean, so this was...
Making
this
you
was
the most popular boy.
Apex yeah. of my yeah. popularity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the one boy absent in this photo is a boy in my class called Paul Blunn, who made the terrible mistake of deciding to be a racist the week before the party. And he decided, noticing the word Greece, as in the country, and then Greece as in Grease, he started calling me a greasy chip from Greece, and he's sort of taunting me over a number of days. So I sort of, excuse the pun, battered him. And he never came, and he regretted it ever since.
But so much of the book is about the, you know, your Greek family kind of being, you know, and the British culture on the outside. There's a certain amount of tension. You watch Love Thy Neighbour, and the same thing is happening to you. There's some people next door who
don't
want
Love Thy Neighbour was more, the big one was Mind Your Language with my parents. You know, Mind Your Language came on during a period where my parents were between shops. They'd sold one shop, and my dad was waiting for an opportunity to buy another chip shop. And he used to buy chip shops that had been closed for a long time and try and increase their value by kind of building them up again. And so there was a period when he was at home, which coincided with the time Mind Your Language started. And for the people who don't know, Mind Your Language was a sitcom that was based, kind of the idea of it was a night school, and you had different students from different kind of countries, and every student was like every cliche of that nationality sort of funneled into one character. And so you had this very austere sort of Austrian woman and this Chinese student that carried a Chairman Mao book around with her, and so on and so on. And there was a stereotypical Greek called Max, who was constantly at odds with the stereotypical kind of randy Italian guy called, what was he called now, Max? It'll come to me. And they would fight over the affections of this very glamorous French woman called Danielle, I think. And my parents loved it, you know. They just thought it was the best thing ever, because, of course, they were they'd never seen a representation of themselves on television before. And so they would just be clutching cushions like Des O'Connor, just like laughing at it. So that was that was Mind Your Language.
What I love about the book is that, and this is, you know, as you say, it's quite a long book, but I don't mean that in the sense of hard to read or anything. No, but you've allowed yourself the space to cover the detail in all kinds of ways, and I'm fascinated by what I've learned about running a fish and chip shop, and when West Brom footballers in the days when they used to buy chips,
yeah, that's right,
on the way home from games, didn't they, after a few pints?
That's right. Yeah, that was towards the end of my parents' tenure running a very modernistic hexagonal looking building called the Threepenny Bit, which had it survived would be a kind of modernist sort of monument, but sadly it didn't. And West Bromwich Albion footballers used to come in on a Saturday night and get their fish and chips from my dad. And my dad would told me very late in the day that this was happening. And one of the leitmotifs, probably the only leitmotif in the book, is this autograph book that I had, which I was desperate to get the autograph of any kind of celebrity in it. So, and it's a little bit like, you know, like Charlie Brown and the football, and, you know, Lucy pulling away from the football. Every time I try and get an autograph, something goes wrong. It's either, and so my dad, it's the last Saturday that my parents were going to be working at the shop. So I said to my dad, can I just spend the whole day at the chip shop? Thinking that, you know, knowing that I'd get like Brian Robson was a regular, Len Cantello was in the West Bromwich Albion team, Peter Barnes before he moved to Manchester United. This was very exciting to me. And just the previous week, there had been a great incident where sometime before, there was a match in which Peter Barnes had scored a hat-trick. And so he had if you score a hat-trick, you get the ball. And they were they were kind of having a sort of silly kick around in the shop, and one of them smashed a window. And Brian Robson came into the shop a few days later and gave amply, handsomely compensated my dad for the damage to the window. So my dad always liked Brian Robson.
What a sound bloke. Absolutely.
My dad would always say, Robson is a good man. In his kind of Greek accent.
Break my windows anytime.
So the one thing I forgot to check that day was whether or not West Bromwich Albion were playing at home. And so in the book, I describe a very forlorn journey back from West Bromwich, which is, again, is kind of like the reason it's kind of scorched in my memory is because, my dad allowed me to play a compilation tape I'd made. And it's that thing of, like, sometimes, the right songs at the right time can just sort of, again, which is what the book's about, describe your situation to you. So, just a song like Carrie by Cliff Richard... has anyone heard Caravan Song by Barbara Dixon? Does anyone know that song? I mean, that still slays me to this day. That core anglais on it, and the great thing is about being mates with Mike Batt, who wrote it, is that years later you can say to him, do you mind if I quote this song extensively in my book? And he's like, great, yeah, no problem. And secondly, you can say, God, this song really moved me unimaginably so at the time. And then Mike says to you, well, it's ostensibly a song about caravans, but actually I was about to separate from my wife, and actually it's a song about what I was going through, but actually I just made up a chorus about caravans to sort of slightly obscure the fact that it's about... And I thought, God, and that's why it kind of slightly resonated with... the kind of fissures that I was starting to notice in my own parents' relationship, and which nicely brings us on to ABBA.
Yes, because go on, you write an awful lot about
ABBA. Huge amount about ABBA. You talk about the listening to ABBA records and realising the depth of emotion that could be got across in music. In fact, you write about Waterloo and saying it's like the recording of a war or fireworks.
That's how it sounds.
You call them the sculptors of the zeitgeist. It's great to find someone applying that to ABBA, which is not often the case.
Well, slightly more, thankfully, these days. But I sort of think that ABBA is sort of the Greek chorus, really, to the entire book. And ABBA, of course, were also people who, certainly at the beginning, I was very happy about the idea that, maybe they might want to be my parents. And, things about, people used to say, well, ABBA is so boring. I used to love the fact that ABBA were boring. So you'd see ABBA on Swap Shop. And, Benny and Bjorn would turn up and be interviewed by Noel Edmonds. They looked like they were just, delegates from a sort of Swedish plastics company that had come to sort of some kind of expo to sort of work out how many moldings they needed to buy for their plastics chairs for Q4, and I'd love that about them because that made them more mysterious to me, because then you'd cut to a video of Knowing Me Knowing You, which is just an exercise in absolute desolation. And the great thing about Knowing Me, Knowing You, if you're a child, is it talks about a relationship ending like it's the end of the world, which, of course, if you're a child and you think about your parents separating, it is the end of the world. It was totally... And you go, how are these guys writing this music? And it kind of... There just seemed to be an ABBA song for every situation. Money, Money, Money was like... to me just sounded like a sort of explication of my parents' quandary. They were immigrants. Money really was the sort of index of their sacrifice, being here in a place that they didn't really want to be in because they couldn't really go back home. And so it goes on, throughout their career.
So, but then, things start to happen as you're growing up. You get the arrival of punk rock,
And a lot of it's seen through your brother, who's 4 years older than you. You're actually too young. I mean, you were sort of eight or whatever when punk rock happens. But it's really interesting seeing an eight-year-old write about what impact that has. So what do you remember about the arrival of the Pistols?
What I remember about the arrival of the Pistols is really them really having an effect, certainly in my part of Birmingham. At a time when, certainly in the music press, they were adjudged to be over, really. The Great Rock and Roll Swindle was the first Pistols album that entered our house. And that was really... They weren't over. To us, they weren't over. Actually, punk made more sense in a way at the tail end of the 70s, yeah. When you had these sort of slightly ersatz groups like Sham 69, the members singing songs like, you know, The Sound of the Suburbs, obviously, Solitary Confinement. These songs which sort of kind of articulated this sense of nothing much going on in the suburbs. And the Pistols, I don't know, songs like Silly Thing and their version of Come On Everybody, they got played more in our house initially than Anarchy in the UK. That did change. He brought those in later as well. But
give us your interpretation of Roxanne by the Police, which is fantastically original.
So Roxanne was my introduction to the world of prostitutes. I was just about to reach my 10th birthday, I think, if I remember rightly. And this song was just, it kind of haunted me, but I didn't know why. And this line about the red light was why did Sting want to, what was this business about put on the red light? So I said to my brother, why is she putting on a red light? And he just looked at me witheringly. You know when your older brother tries to look as mature beyond their years to accentuate the gulf between you? And you must know that, mustn't you? Of course I'm 9. Why would I know that? And he's like, because she's a prostitute. I said, okay. What's a prostitute? And he said, It's someone you sort of pay them money to have sex with them, and why? That's okay, but you talk like about sex like it's a good thing, and like money like it's a good thing. Why is it so? You know. Anyway, it was explained. And the upshot of Roxanne was basically it kind of made Sting this sort of heroic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah,
kind of. His band called the Police, so I kind of almost thought of him as
trying to rescue prostitutes.
It's like
yeah. Yeah, 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 and to try and persuade them to
see.
To
what I love this throughout the book, that you kind of impute innocent motives to things that are not innocent at all. And my favourite example, I think, is "Greased Lightning," the song from Greece, the soundtrack of Greece.
Yeah.
Where there's a line, it's a real pussy wagon.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I just thought it was like some means of carrying cats from Montreal. I mean, why on earth would I not think that?
Yeah. I think you actually say, it's such a great car, even the cats want to get in.
Yeah.
Something like that. I love that idea. Yeah.
But it's...
But I suppose, how else would you...
But you're a child, and you know everything is confusing when you're a child. 70% of what you see it does not make sense anymore. And, from the fact... Because, of course, your parents are too busy to explain everything. You know, so you have to sort of learn things in this circuitous way.
Yeah.
You know, why your parents... Why... There's no reason why my parents should know that I get Freddie Starr confused with Fred Astaire, or there's something called the Pink Panther, and but there's sometimes you watch films called the Pink Panther, and there isn't a Pink Panther in them, but then there's this program that's got a Pink Panther in them, and just why, you know?
Yeah.
You start to get a bit of financial independence, and you start to buy records in a big way. And the way you bought a lot of records at Woolworths. Were you the classic Woolworths singles buyer in the days when Woolies was where most of the singles in the UK were sold?
Yeah, I used to gaze adoringly at this wall, which had like 75 little shelves on it, each one of them corresponding to a number in the charts.
The chart, yes.
And that was, you know, that was my sort of. That was like my kind of stock exchange, my sort of, you know, that was where all the important information was stored. And you go in there on a Wednesday and all the new chart positions, everything had been kind of put into its new chart positions.
Right. Yes,
and then and then what you could see which songs you could wait and get half price, because
they cut the corner off them, don't they, when they
if Give Me Back My Heart by Dollar was at number 68, so it was on the 68 shelf, and they had 6 copies left. You knew that if you came in after school on Wednesday, you could get Give Me Back My Heart for 50 pence. Which I did.
Have you still got all these records?
Most of them, yeah. I've got Give Me Back My Heart, definitely.
Right. Say, are you the kind of person where you look at a record and you think, I could tell you where I bought that?
I think that's one of the great things about, you know, if you can, holding on to your stuff, because it just becomes this three-dimensional diary, which, you know, it tells you what you were doing. You know, I stream music as well, but I do try and buy records because I like the fact that you can attach a memory to the purchase in the way that you can't really with a download.
There's lots of records that you talk about, and we may have time to talk about, you know, listening to the Velvet Underground being a really good example. Well, another one is the Jam Setting Suns.
Mm.
And you're there with your elder brother, and you sit there and take it intensely seriously, listening to this record, trying to find out what it's all about. And why did it have such an impact on you?
Again, you know, I sort of think that, you know, records either connect or they don't connect emotionally, and then later on you can figure out how they have found purchase in your life. And I think with Setting Suns, which Paul Weller himself says now, it's a record, it's a sort of farewell to all that, you know, it's inspired by, you know, a kind of naivety in a childhood to which he can never return. It's about how, you know, the alliances you forge may not necessarily survive into adulthood, but, you know, they're meaningful and they make you the person that you are. And you sort of, you know, you see on songs like Thick as Thieves, which are just, you know, there's so much heart in those songs, because it's a little bit like one final audit of a world to which he can never return. And, you know, that's carried on to a certain degree in Sound Effects as well. It's... you know, I think Paul Weller at that point was just writing out of his skin in terms of noticing that kind of beauty in the small details of suburban life that no one else was kind of putting down. And that's kind of why, slightly loftily, I compare him to William Blake, because I just think, you know, I think that's entertainment is... just to this day, you know, astonishing. And that, you know, I think I said it kind of glistens like rain on a wet cortina under a street lamp, because that's just, it's a loving chronicle of just the magic that you sometimes see just on a suburban street in the middle of nowhere.
But you're also, at the same time, you are, you know, you're equally respectful of people who are less exalted than Paul Weller.
Well, yeah, because at the time I wasn't old enough to try and be cool, so I wasn't really making those distinctions. I was just sort of trying to honour the emotions that these songs instilled in me. And in a way, actually, I think there was a period in my 20s when I was a music journalist where I kind of wasn't doing that, and that kind of makes me a bit sad, to be honest. I sort of do try and do that. In many ways, I think I was smarter when I was 9.
But it's
than
the
pre-cool
phase of your life.
Seriously, you're smarter when you were 9 than when you were a music journalist.
In some senses, because I was absolutely honest, you know. And and I try and be honest now, and I try and, you know, really absolutely honour the emotions that I have. The Bee Gees are a really good example. I think how many people have heard Spirits Having Flown by the Bee Gees? Cheers. So you'll hopefully know what I'm about to say. I think Spirits Having Flown is just literally one of the greatest albums of all time. And the mood, there's a peculiar mood to that record. I mean, the Bee Gees, absolute masters, and they did it in the late 60s, and they were doing it at this point, writing about love as though it's a sort of almost like an affliction or a kind of heart disease or something. And there's just an existential weight about them on the Spirits Having Flown album, which you can hear on the song Spirits Having Flown, you know, How Deep Is Your Love, all these songs which, you know, Love You Inside Out. you know, they don't sound happy. There's a kind of pensiveness which carries on to the final album. And I can only think that subconsciously it's because they're on top of the world and the only way is down. And I think at some level they know that. And I think it's all over that record.
Yes, it's an interesting point.
It is.
I think that's what I think is going on.
So and you also make the point. I'm guessing that you don't subscribe to the theory of guilty pleasures.
Well, I understand the importance of guilty pleasures. I think personally, I think guilty pleasures is a sort of, you know, some people are more insecure about declaring their affections than others. And I think the job that guilty pleasures does is it provides a sort of quarantine for records that have yet to be reevaluated and welcomed back into the canon.
Yeah.
And and that's, we saw it happen most memorably with ABBA in the early 90s when ABBA Gold came out. They were just sort of held there for a while, and then Bjorn again were doing their thing, and all of this sort of, then we've said, no, come in ABBA, we love you, we actually love you more than almost anyone else in the world. And that, I think that's what guilty pleasures
is. When you're 10, I think it is, John Lennon dies, and you write about your reaction to that, and also work out that John Lennon, you didn't realise, was a member of the Beatles. And you didn't realise that Paul McCartney of Wings was a member of the Beatles either. And so you embark on this journey to go back and discover the Beatles.
Yeah,
it's really interesting hearing that written from the point of view of somebody who's 10. What was your recollection of all that?
There was a very important character, person in the, she's not a character, she's a real person, called Jed, short for Geraldine. She's the girl next door. She's 4 years older than me. And she's a bit like an older sister, basically. She's endlessly patient with me in ways that to this day I don't entirely understand. She was at the launch the other day, and it was so nice to see her there. But I came home. On the day that John Lennon died, I went to school, and then when I came back, I knocked on Jed's door. I was always knocking on her door for one reason or another, and she's very tolerant of me. And she said, "It's terrible about John Lennon, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah, really." And in a way, I sort of felt that because I was so more connected with pop music. I sort of, even though most of what I loved about John Lennon was this record here, which I just thought...
It's double fantasy. Like
stop, well, it's kind of specifically like starting over.
Yeah.
Because, and I didn't really understand why critics were so sniffy about it, because, and, you know, they're saying, well, you know, he's a bit toothless now, and, you know, the politically engaged John Lennon of before is, you know, maybe he needs to come back and so forth. I just thought this is like, I just love this like you would love any pop song, because it is just a very sweet pop song. It's like, there's that, it's very influenced by, as he always was, by 60s girl groups. There's that bit which sounds a bit like Don't Worry Baby by the Beach Boys. Who would have a problem with any of that? So I adored that song, and I also adored it because that was kind of how, you know, one day I wanted to fall in love and feel the feelings that this song seemed to evoke. So that it sort of hit me hard, even though I didn't know about the Beatles. So anyway, I went to Jed's house, and she said, you know, she said something about the Beatles and about the fact that Paul McCartney was in the Beatles, and I just like, Paul McCartney from Wings. I said, yes, don't you? Yeah, Paul McCartney, he was in the Beatles as well, didn't you know? Paul McCartney and John Lennon were in the same band. That's amazing. So they're like a super group. Yeah. They were like a super group. And she played me, she got a biscuit tin of records that her older brother had left in the house before he'd left to become a teacher. And she played me I Am the Walrus. And
what a place to start. That's you're going to start with "She Loves You," then. That's precocious.
It was like the petri dish from which ELO were grown, and then she lent me an album, The Beatles Oldies but Goodies, and which was a 1966 compilation. And I went home and I played side one, and it was just fucking mind-blowing. I mean, it was like, it just, it was like, I'd been in an accident. I couldn't remember. You know, when you're in an accident, you can't remember what happens just before. And just, you know, she loves you. I want to hold your hand. You know, it was just like, and another one, and another one. It's just, why have people been withholding this information from me?
And well, they had it in those days, hadn't they?
You couldn't get it. And then I remember I was so upset, so I taped it and then gave the record back to Jed. And I just thought, well, I've got some very important... I just need to tell people about this. And so, and I thought, well, I need to tell my dad because I think maybe he doesn't know about the Beatles because otherwise he would have played them to me. And so and every day, because he had a chip shop, the only day that he could go to the tip to throw away all the old sort of chicken boxes and what have you from the chip shop was on a Sunday morning. So I invited myself to the dump with him one Sunday morning with the express purposes of playing him the Beatles. And so I went out into the car and he was just kind of like, there wasn't any room in the passenger seat. It was just full of boxes. And my dad said, "What, you're coming with me?" I said, so he kind of sort of shoved some like smelly old boxes out of the way, and I just sat there and I put the cassette in, and it was raining. I remember it was raining really, really hard, and we were just pulling into the municipal tip when Eleanor Rigby was playing. And it just like, it was just a pretty, I mean, it was, I loved it, but it was a kind of dismal scenario, really. You know, it was like everything was smelly, and we were in the tip. And then he just politely just took the cassette out, and then he didn't say anything else. So my experiment failed, sadly.
One of the groups who figure more significantly in your book than probably they have ever figured in any.
They're not in England's Dreaming, that's for sure.
Are the Baron Knights?
No, I know. I adored the Baron Knights. Again,
remind people who the Baron Knights were.
They were the first group
I ever saw, actually.
It wasn't the golden age of the Baron Knights, was it? It was the kind of reborn Baron Knights.
To me, that was the golden age of the Baron Knights.
But describe it. They were kind of parody group, weren't they?
So the Baron Knights thing was, and the first record, the first 7-inch single I ever bought was a Baron Knights record called A Taste of Aggro, and it was a hit late in 1978. And the thing that the Baron Knights did, many of you will know this, is they would do a medley of three songs that were in the charts in the preceding year and change the lyrics so that they were funny. And I saw them on Top of the Pops doing that, and I just thought, I mean, that was my punk, you know. It was a kind of like, how are they allowed to do this? Do Boney M not mind that they've just taken the Mickey out of their song and done? And it just seemed like the naughtiest thing that you could ever do, you know. And so I was just full of admiration for them, and yeah, I just thought, that's just amazing. So, and as it happens, the following day, we were going past the record shop. My mum saw me looking longingly in the display, and she said, "Do you want a record?" I said, "Can I have a record?" She said, "Yes, you know." We went in there, and my first record was A Taste of Aggro, and that just started. I was weirdly loyal towards the bands that I like. I would carry on buying their records after, which is, you know, we're not talking about sort of, you know, like a Joy Division fan here. We're talking about like Racy and the Baron Knights, you know. And so I would be ordering their records. I would be ordering their records because they were too unpopular for the record shop to get them in. I went to see the Baron Knights in Cabaret with my
fantastic sequence when you meet them and try and get their autograph on them.
Yeah, I tried to. That was another band whose autograph I tried to get. I mean, I probably won't spoil. This story has got a bit of a dramatic denouement to it, but I saw them in Cabaret and hung around afterwards in an attempt to and did. I tried to impress them. I'm not going to say any more.
Okay, fair enough.
It didn't go very well, though.
Yeah. Your love for groups like this is fascinating. I was thinking of Pete and I, we had dinner somewhere years ago, I remember, and I was talking about my time at Smash Hits and reeling off all the groups I'd interviewed, and the only time he stopped me was when I said I interviewed Racy.
Oh,
yeah. I said, "You interviewed Racy?"
I loved Racy. Does anyone remember Racy here?
Yeah.
My knees would never forgive me if I did that. Well, Race, again, it's that's the thing of music explaining your life to you. You know, you look for versions of yourself in pop music. And this slightly sort of, you know, adenoidal, listless, scrawny, relatively friendless child. You know, I wasn't going to like Bruce Springsteen, was I? I was going to like the little man from Racy, who looked a bit needy and pathetic. He was my man, you know. I bought everything by them. I followed them to the bitter end. Then final 1982 release, Not Too Young to Get Married.
There's a great moment where you see Dog Eat Dog, Adam and the Ants doing Dog Eat Dog on Top of the Pops, and talk about the effect the next day, that the whole school has already appears to have been changed.
Yeah, I mean...
New fashion, and Soft Cell as well.
It was the news, you know, and Soft Cell. I was so happy that the girl that lived two doors away, Helen Day, who was 2 years older than me at school, and Helen had a very... emphatic, slammed into adolescence very emphatically, and she was firstly she was obsessed with Adam Ant, and then Mark Almond just became the object of her adoration. And at my school, there was my school one time decided to put on this entertainment, this kind of talent contest at lunchtime in the school hall. And Helen, oh, I've just told her real name. I didn't call her Helen, although it's fine now because she likes the book. But in the book. Because you have to do that, you see. So in the book, she's called Emily May, and Emily, Emily decides to do a solo dance to Tainted Love, and with an abrupt cut into Bedsitter, and she kind of, I'd heard that this was going to happen. I just thought this was going to be, just a all time brilliant cringe moment to behold. So I kind of went in and, you know, and she was the laughing stock of the school. She changed into this tiny little sort of sequined, like a blouse that she was wearing as a dress, and she'd put makeup on and stuff. And she did this ridiculous dance to Tainted Love, which at the time I just thought it was just embarrassing and like, why'd she do it? She's humiliated herself in front of the school. And the nice thing about writing a book like this is you realize what it was that she was trying to do. You know, she knew that people were going to laugh at her. I didn't give her the credit for that. She knew. She was honoring her love of Mark, and she was, and in a sense, that was braver than anything I did in those entire 5 years at school. It's like having a new tattoo. You want to just show it off, and it hurts, and people might think it's silly. But you don't care because you have this total, total love for these people.
Yeah. This is one of the things that goes through the book, isn't it? It's a very kind of forgiving book, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, things have turned out okay for me, so that maybe that's a factor. I don't know, but we're all trying to figure our way. You know, you're just trying to figure your way into adulthood, and you know, we're all kind of a bit lost, and we're all sort of, you know. Not victims of circumstance, but certainly we're all trying to sort of, we're all battling, you know, our various sort of adversities. And as kids, you know, kids turn on each other very easily because they're scared. You know, all that stuff happens at school. I've got no, you know.
So this book, it goes up to when you're 13?
Yeah.
What's next?
I don't know. I don't know if there needs to be another one. I'm just happy that... that I finished this one.
Right.
We'll see. You know, I don't. This is one more book than I ever thought I'd write. In all honesty, I never thought I'd write a book in my life, and I almost kind of tricked myself into writing this one by not looking for a publisher. I just thought, well, if I start writing, let's see how it goes, and if it's kind of not great at the end of it, then I don't have to show it to anyone.
Well, it's fantastic.
It's a terrific.
Thanks very much for talking to us about it. Pete Pavides.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.